fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of Social Flight Live is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at Avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at SocialFlightLive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an amazing show for you this evening. Legendary astronaut, test pilot, aeronautical engineer, and air racer, Hoot Gibson is here. This is Hoot's third visit to Social Flight Live. It took three visits to even barely scratch the surface, I think, of telling his personal story. And we are going to do that. We are going to talk about his fascinating aviation story, focusing tonight on his many aviation world records. Before we get started, just a few things. As we are racing from fall into winter here and the holidays are approaching fast, there are tons of events out there in Social Flight. And I encourage all of you, check out socialflight.com or the free Social Flight mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. I'm telling you, there are educational events. There are still fly-ins going on. There are holiday events, hangar dances, Santa events, you name it. It's all going on in Social Flight. You can check it all out. It's completely free. We are also giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. All you need to do is play our Fly to Win challenge. They get the app and just checking at your local airport, and you'll be able to enter in to win there. So very, very simple. And if you get on our leaderboard by checking in at multiple airports and competing there, you get extra entries in that prize drawing. And again, December 1st, giving away Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset might be your gift for the holidays coming your way. And lastly, we have our FAA Learning Center. So again, go to socialflight.com, click on FAA credits, and there are just tons of courses that you can take there for FAA Wings credit. You can take courses on demand in your own time. If you are a mechanic, especially one with an IA, with an inspection authorization, you can even get your 8 hours of continuing education directly from Social Flight, completely free. You get your certificates. It's all there. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Continental Aerospace Technologies. We fly behind a Continental IO-550 engine in our Bonanza and always use Continental parts, including their OEM cylinders when we did a top overhaul several years ago. And we use Continental services in Fairhope, Alabama. That's the factory's owned FBO that actually does all the work. They are absolute experts. We had them put the cylinders on, and they have just been rock solid ever since. And they just reached out to me and have some big news just to let all of you know. Many of their engines, both new and rebuilt, are available right now with less than 75-day lead time. And there's a whole list on their website of what they've got. But one of the biggest things is between now and December 31st, and I believe it started on September 1st, but until the end of the year, they are offering a limited time warranty extension as well. Between 6 and 12 months, depending on what engine is or what you get a free extension of your warranty as well. So check all that out at Continental.Aero. That is Continental Aerospace Technologies, and pretty cool things as a gift to the end of the year if your engine's timed out and you need a new one. Now to tonight's broadcast. Robert Lee Hoot Gibson is a former American naval officer and aviator, test pilot, and aeronautical engineer. He was selected as an astronaut by NASA in 1978, flew five missions, STS-41B in 84, 61C in 86, 27 in 88, 47 in 1992, and STS-71 in 1995. These missions included the groundbreaking docking mission with the Russian Mir space station. All that said, his crowning achievement may very well be serving as NASA's chief of the astronaut office from 1992 to 1994, one of only four individuals in history to have held that position at the time. Hoot's story extends well beyond space, and as a professional pilot, arena air racer, and aircraft experimenter, Hoot began pushing limits and setting aviation world records nearly 40 years ago. He also worked alongside his good friend, the late, great Bruce Bohannon, in setting some of those records in the famous Pushy Galore aircraft. And Bruce has been someone that I knew as well and was here on the show. And he is very, very well missed, but we'll certainly talk about him tonight. I am absolutely thrilled to have him here with us tonight to tell us some of these amazing stories. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, my friend, the incomparable Hoot Gibson. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great, Jeff. Great to hear your voice again, and happy to be back with Social Flight.
I am so, so thrilled. And I'll tell you, there aren't many, many times that there is someone here on the show who the breadth of whose story is so remarkable as yours. And I am so grateful that you're taking so much time to be able to tell it all to us, because I'll tell you, if we'd only had you for only one episode, we wouldn't have even been able to get close to some of the things you've done.
Yeah, we didn't get, well, we got very far on that first episode, but there were just many more things that we could be talking about, which, and here we are.
So here we could talk for hours. Well, tonight we're going to talk about pushing limits and breaking records. And I know this is something close to your heart. And so I want to start with what it was that triggered this thing inside you that said, hey, maybe I'd like to be doing some world records. Maybe I want to be in the book. What brought that about?
It all came about, Jeff, after I put the new wing on my Formula One racer, my home-built Cassett, which, you know, I've modified it so much, it's more of a Gibson now than it is a Cassett. There's some Cassett left over, but it's more of a Gibson special. And from the first time I bought that airplane in 1983, and I spent nearly a year rebuilding it, flew it for several years with the original wing, and the Cassett has a constant chord, low aspect ratio wing, wooden wing, and I knew that I could make that airplane go faster, climb better, go higher by designing and building my own wing. And so the image that's on the screen right now is with the new wing that I designed and built for it. And, you know, I should be able to do that. I'm an aeronautical engineer. That's what I was training to do. And so starting in 1987, I started working on this new wing. And took me 3 years to finish it because NASA and these space shuttle flights got in my way. They kept taking up a whole lot of my time. And so it took me 3 years to build this wing, get it integrated onto the airplane. And I could see right away, Jeff, that holy smokes, this really improves the performance of it. It has a 6% airfoil, which means it's only 6% thick. And this picture is the wing, obviously before I put the fiberglass skins over it. It's made of a foam core, very much the way that a Very Easy is made. And I'm holding it by the main spar. And it's interesting, the main spar is the structural element on that wing. That's what goes across the fuselage. And I did a static load test because I had calculated the strengths of it, which I should be able to do, and I did, and I built.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane, Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
That wing in my garage, and from the first time I flew it, the first time I lifted it off, I went down the runway, got up to speed, lifted it off very briefly, chopped the throttle, and settled back down. I could see from how much time it took to come back down and land that it really had a great lift to drag ratio. And so that kind of got me to thinking about this airplane. And Bruce Bohan, a dear friend of both of ours, dear friend of mine for 40 years, he happened to show me the National Aeronautic Association record book at one point. And I got to looking in that book, and I saw that for my airplane category, class C1A, which is piston engine, gross weight between 500 and 1,000 kilograms, which is, I think, 660 pounds to 1,102 pounds. The world record for altitude in horizontal flight was 25,000 feet. So I took kind of a quick jaunt in it up to 25,000 feet and got there, really expeditiously.
And, let me just go try this out.
Yeah, let's go try this out. And so that told me that, hey, I can have that record. And it had stood for a number of years. And so I set about working on doing that. And Bruce Bohannon was a big participant helping me. He was always, you know, there was never much of a competition between us, although there's always a competition between pilots, as you know. But he and I worked together on a lot of projects, and he helped me with this record. And it came about in January of 1991 that I got all the documentation, and I got all the prerequisites, and the airplane had to have an official weigh-in, and it had to have the altimeter, static systems inspected and certified. And prior to that, I didn't have a static system in it. I just had the altimeter in the cabin, in the cockpit with me. And so I had to install a static port and a pressure line and have it tested and certified. And so January the 31st, 1971, I took my airplane and I took it up to an altitude of 27,040 feet. And I was a little disappointed because in practice I had been to 28,000. And so when I only got to 27,040 feet, I was starting to run out of fuel. I had a 10-gallon tank, and most of the time was above 10,000 feet, and much of it was above 20,000 feet. And so I wasn't burning that much fuel up at that altitude. The mixture was pulled way back up high like that. And eventually I said, well, for the final 10 minutes of the climb, Jeff, I gained 350 feet in 10 minutes. That's a rate of climb of 35 feet per minute. I didn't have a rate of climb gauge, and that's okay because it wouldn't have registered anyway. But anyway, I made it up to 27,040 feet, came back and landed, and it was one of the longest flights that I've ever had in that airplane because it only had a 10-gallon tank. But I had plenty of fuel when I landed, and by golly, that was a world altitude and horizontal flight record.
And what did they find out when they actually checked? So you have to take certified instruments in with you, right? It's basically a device that they do. Why don't you explain to people, I guess, how it works when you go and want to break a world record, because you don't just do it and then call someone and say, hey, I did it. Please.
Yes. Hey, I did it. Yeah, I broke the record. Yeah, put me down for it. No, I had to have an official observer from the National Aeronautic Association who got to be a good friend. Buck Hilbert was, I think he was chairman of the Contest and Records Board at the time. And he had to come down to Houston and he had to witness the weighing of the airplane. And of course, it was a slam dunk. It had to fit between 660 and 1102 pounds. And it weighed about 830. So, you know, it's square in the middle of the range. So there wasn't any issue there. But he had to see the documentation that showed that the altimeter and the static system had been tested and were accurate. And then there was another documentation that I had to have. And that was Buck Hilbert brought along with him a barograph, which is a recording, basically a recording, not an altimeter, but a gadget that records altitude versus time. And it shows how high I went. And we mounted that right behind my seat in the cabin. I also had a video system to videotape my instrument panel so that when I landed, the quickest way to say, yes, it looks like you got it, was we could look at the videotape and verify that, yes, indeed, I got over 27,000 feet, and the record was 25,020 feet, something like that. So I had definitely broken the record. So there were lots of congratulations. We may have opened some liquid and celebrated a little bit. And, of course, Bruce was there, and I don't know. I didn't notify really anybody about it, but there was a whole big crowd there for it. And so we were all celebrating. And so that was my first world record. And at that point, I had been flying my Cassatt now for three, four years to include the new wing. The new wing didn't go on till 1990.
I want to show people that wing real quick again, because and some differences about it, because we really don't want to gloss over giving you proper credit for the engineering that you did in order to do this. This was before, right? This is how the cast was before you actually made any changes. And then we saw you with the design of it, but you had to make sure that was strong too, right?
Yes. I did the stress analysis, and I should be able to do that. That's what aeronautical engineers learn to do. So I did a stress analysis. Now, I have to admit, I had not worked with carbon fiber before. Well, I had worked with it, but I hadn't worked with it in a structural application. And so I noticed, Jeff, when I had the wing all assembled, and in this picture, the skins have been put on it. I also had added some fiberglass ribs for torsion, to take out the torsion or to tolerate the torsion. But one thing I noticed is I could grab one end of that wing and lift it, and it weighed about 115, 120 pounds. I could see it bend when I was lifting it. And that made me nervous. That made me a little bit nervous. And I said, okay, did I mess up my calculations? If I'm going to take this thing up in the air and to race it in Formula One class, you had to demonstrate a 6G maneuver with a G meter in the cockpit, of course. And so I knew I was going to do 6Gs in the air. So I calculated how much weight I needed to load on it. And I want to emphasize what is taking all of this load. Every bit of this load is taken up by that main spar. That carbon fiber main spar, and only the top and the bottom of the spar caps were carbon fiber. The webs, the front and back of the spar, those were 45 degree direction fiberglass. And so I put the equivalent of a 6.8 G loading on it, which was 5,440 pounds of cement.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Bags on that wing, 32 on each wing, 64 80-pound cement bags is what I loaded that wing up with. And the wing is perfectly flat. And you look at this photo, and it's not flat anymore. So this is what that wing would look like at 6.8 Gs. It takes on quite a bend. It's a very pretty bend from an engineering standpoint. There's very little deflection in the center, which the spar is the thickest at the center, of course. And then as you go outboard, it's somewhat of a parabolic curve that the wing makes, because that's where the spar is thinner and that's where the loading is less as you move outboard. So anyway, it passed that test. I was able to borrow a pallet of cement bags because Teresa Stokes, who was one of our gang there at Clover Field, she knew the people at the lumber yard and asked if I could come in there and clutter up their lumber yard and borrow a pallet of cement bags. And so that's how we put together this static test. And there was a bunch of celebrating after that, which, of course, this was before the record. And then it took me, Jeff, I can't believe it took this long, but it took me, I think it took 6 months for me to put the finish on that wing, because it was just the rough fiberglass finish that was on it when I did the static test. And now that thing has to be slick as it can be to let the air flow over it very smoothly. And so I think it took me 6 or 8 months to do the sanding and filling and refilling and priming and sanding the primer and then painting it. And this is the final configuration.
Wow. Wow. And there's a reason that it's a different color, right?
Yes. Yeah. I would have loved to have made it this same jade green metallic that I had on the wooden wing. But with fiberglass in a room temperature cure, you've got to do it in a relatively light color. And that's why most all of the very easiest are painted white, because they are a room temperature cure of the fiberglass, of the resin that's in the fiberglass. And if you get that out in the hot Texas sun and it gets above a certain temperature, it will soften up and your wing will change shape. And so it had to be light colors. I didn't want a white wing on it, so I did a very pale yellow, as you can see. Mm-hmm. And that went pretty well with the green color.
So that was your first record, and that was in the actual cassette there. I'm gonna bring up the picture right now again. Because I've got a little celebratory picture that you did.
Yes, this was right when I shut down. So I landed after, like I say, it was an hour and 50 minutes, I think, was how long that flight was. And I had to taxi back and not open the canopy because, you know, I could have had a throwdown barograph or something like that, or I could have had a throwdown video. So I had to keep the canopy closed until I got stopped right by Buck Hilbert, and that's Buck in the red jacket. And then I could open the cockpit and hand him the video camera with the proof of where I had been. And then he could retrieve the barograph and verify that, yes, he saw it go into my airplane, and then he saw it come out of my airplane. And then when they reduced all the data on the barograph, it confirmed what we had on the video recording as well.
It's very curious to me that they went to such lengths about the altimeter in your aircraft when what they're really relying on is the barograph. And I remember Dick Rattan telling me how they did multiple sealed barographs for the around the world flight too, to make sure that he hadn't landed at any point. during that, the same concept of putting that in there, and yet they still gave you a hard time about your equipment on the aircraft.
Well, yes, and now actually the most accurate altitude data is what's from the altimeter and the video recording. Yeah, that's the most accurate. And the barograph, of course, backs it up, because as you mentioned, if I had snuck out there somewhere and landed and had a throwdown videotape and I threw it in there, the barograph would show that that happened. But the barograph is a constantly scrolling line on like a wax cylinder, basically, is what it's doing. And it's recording altitude versus time. And you can see that, yeah, okay, it's over 25,000, it's probably 27,000, but the most accurate measurement is the video recording.
Well, that explains that. That makes sense.
Yeah, so that was how that happened.
So now you've got your first world record, and you've basically found in a book that there was an opportunity for you with the aircraft almost pretty much where it was. So where'd you go from there? It sounds like you kind of got bitten by the bug of going after.
Yeah, there was even more, because the Federal Aeronautique Internationale is the one who actually certifies the world record. The National Aeronautic Association certifies it as a U.S. national record and then forwards it to the FAI for them to certify it as a world record. But along the way, the FAI said, okay, we're going to award Hoot one of three Louis Blériot medals for the year 1991, and they can award three of those for world records involving altitude or speed or distance. And so I was awarded one of those for an altitude record in 1991. And this is a funny story. It has an image of Louis Blériot on it, who, of course, made the first flight across the English Channel in, let's see, what year was that? 1909? I think it was 1909. The medallion has an image of Louis Blériot on it with a pilot's helmet on over it, a leather helmet. And it looks amazingly like Bruce Bohan. And so he put up with all kinds of flack because, gee, Bruce, they put your face on the Louis Blériot medal. And I think he'd hold up one finger at us when we said something like that to him. But anyway, so I was awarded, I don't think they awarded three of them that year. I think I was awarded the only Louis Blériot for the year 1991.
Wow.
And then there was more that came after that, which you started to allude to.
Yeah, so you got bit by that bug apparently, and you started looking at other ways that you might knock down some other world records.
Well, Bruce was there, and you know, in that last photo that you showed, we saw the TV cameras and all that, and he came to the realization that, you know what, this is a great way to get a lot of publicity, and he was looking for sponsorship for Pushy Galore. For his airplane. And so he got in the bug as well of setting world records. And then he also decided that, you know what, I need to have Hoot do a world record because that'll get even more publicity. And so he asked me to do the time to climb to 9,000 meters. And that came about in 1994. And this is a picture of Pushy Galore. It's an all carbon fiber airplane, and it was originally designed by Jim Miller, who was a dear friend of ours as well. And Bruce saw this at the Reno Air Races when he was racing. I forget what he had another Cassatt or something like that. And he made a deal with him to let Bruce build an airplane in his shop using his molds and him supervising. So Jim Miller supervised Bruce building Pushy Galore so Bruce could be the builder, and therefore he could sign it off on its annual inspection every year. And so that's what got us going in Pushy. And so 1994, I took Pushy on an attempt for 9,000 meters, time to climb to 9,000 meters. And if I made it to 9,000 meters, that was going to be a world record because nobody had gone that high in category C1A. No one had ever been that high. And so we were pretty sure that that we could set another world record. Now, Bruce had to make a big modification to Pushy because the airplane was built for Formula One air racing, and the minimum fuel tank size was 5 gallons. And so to hold down weight, everybody put a 5 gallon fuel tank in their racers. And so Bruce only had a 5 gallon fuel tank. And so we could see that to go to 9,000 meters, we're going to burn a lot more fuel than that. And so Bruce had another aluminum tank made, and it formed the backrest in the airplane. So with me sitting in the cockpit, I'm leaning against the tank, and my jacket is pretty much kind of covering it up in this picture. But what I'm leaning against is a gas tank full of 3 gallons of gas, 3 gallons of additional gas, which was enough because the performance of Pushy was greater than my Cassett. I wouldn't have been able to make it to 29,000, what was it, 458 feet, something like that. But Pushy could go there, although the day that I did the record, I went up there and I spent a lot of time trying to get it to go higher, and I pretty much maxed out at an indication of about 28,000 feet, something like that. And I tried different airspeeds and all kinds of techniques to try to get it to go higher, and it wouldn't. And I'll never forget, we flew out of Galveston because I had to get 10 miles offshore to be in international airspace so I could go above 18,000 feet without a transponder and without talking to air traffic control. And so I launched out of Galveston and went out 10 miles and then went up. And then I was starting to get kind of low on fuel and oxygen as well. You don't want to do stuff like this without an oxygen bottle. And so I had an oxygen bottle that went along with me on all of these altitude flights. And I came back and landed, and I was a little disappointed. And Buck Hilbert, once again, was our National Aeronautic Association certifying official for the record attempt. And I told them both, I said, doesn't look like we got it. But they said, well, let's look at the data. And they looked at the barograph, and the barograph showed that, yes, indeed, I had gone to 30,500 feet. And what we all figured out after the fact was there was an abnormal temperature gradient up at altitude. And so where I was only showing that I was at 28,000 feet or so, I was actually at 30,400 feet. So I took that little plastic airplane over 30,000 feet. Wow. And so magically, I had a second world record, another altitude related world record. And so that was a lot of fun too. That was exciting.
That's awesome. And I want to point out something else here, because you've got a little tube next to you in here in this photo. And that's no drinking tube, right?
That's right. And it's not a relief tube either. Over there on that side. Yeah. And that brings up, yeah, Jeff, you and I had talked about this, and that tube, it wasn't possible for us to break into the static line for the altimeter. I'm sorry, for the fuel vent. To break into the vent line for the other fuel tank, because that would have created a real mess. And so what we did was we plumbed the outlet from that tank into a T-fitting, and what I had to do, so there was no vent for that tank. So you notice that that little tube has a like a bolt or something that we had in the end of it. And what I had to do was every 3 or 4 minutes or so was blow into that tube to make sure that the tank was still pressurized. Because again, I'm gonna be drawing fuel out of that tank till it's dry. And so I'm going to have to replace 3 gallons volume in that tank. And it sounds like a real Rube Goldberg. And I guess in many ways it was, but it worked. And
it sounds like you're about to steal fuel from someone.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I'm not sucking on that line. It's blowing on it to keep that tank at pressure. And so that was a second world record for me. And so that was exciting too.
Wow. That's really amazing. You know, I remember remind me, because it must have been well after the Pushy Galore records. But I think when I first met Bruce is when we were both sponsored by Unison many years ago. And he was at Sun and Fun doing a Time to Climb with, I think, what was it, the Flying Tiger or something that he was using? There was another aircraft that he had at the time.
It was probably Jimmy Leeward in his P-51 Mustang.
Oh, no, no. He had this. He had some other aircraft, because he was using Unison's like laser system that he would dial the advance at the time. But
yes,
I'm not sure what the aircraft was he was using.
Oh, okay. But it was probably some big horsepower airplane. And I think Bruce wound up holding the 3,000 meter and the 6,000 meter time to climb record with Pushy as well. So that was a baby rocket ship. That was a hot little airplane.
So now you've got a record in the cassette. You've got a record in Pushy. And where'd you go from there?
Well, 1995, I flew. This was the 100th American manned launch, and it was my fifth mission in the space shuttle, and I went to the Russian space station Mir and docked with the Mir, and we had a number of records, and this is what we looked like docked with the Russian space station. And you can see both of these vehicles are about the same size, and we were both a quarter of a million pounds. And so we built the largest vehicle that had ever been assembled in orbit by combining the Russian space station Mir and the space shuttle Atlantis. And I was docked to them for 5 days. And so the FAI, Federal Aeronautique Internationale, awarded us 3, I think, absolute world records for that mission. And those were assembled mass of spacecraft in orbit, distance traveled in linked flight, and altitude in linked flight. And I'm not sure if any of those records are still held, because the International Space Station came along years later. And I'm pretty darn sure they had a greater.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Terms and conditions apply. You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Mass, and I'm not sure, however, that they went higher. So it might be that I still hold the altitude record for linked flight after quite a few years.
We'll check on that one. How did Bucky feel about going up there in order to check it all out?
I'm sure Buck would have loved to go along with us. So yeah, that could have been fun. But NASA actually did all the certification to support the record. And so that was, you know, that was, I guess I'd say that was probably the easiest record that I wound up with, because NASA did all the legwork. I didn't have to pay for any of the licensing fees or any of those things, because NASA took care of all of that. And so, but that made three more world records for me.
Tell me a little bit. I mean, we've talked about it on a previous show, and we're going to talk about your other record-setting missions. But what's the strongest memory you have from that mission, where you set those records, where you docked with the Mir? What is it that sticks with you the most?
You know, people have asked me, what's your favorite mission? What's your most accomplished mission? And I always answer that one. That was my longest flight. That was a 10-day flight. And but looking at, excuse me, I don't have a cold. Anyway, looking at the degree of difficulty of that mission, where we had to integrate Mission Control Moscow with Mission Control Houston. My crew and I had to attempt to learn to speak Russian. And I say attempt because most of us are engineers, and engineers are good with math and physics and science and all that, and not so great at languages. But we were working with four Russians, and they couldn't speak English. And back then, Russia was poor enough that they could not afford to hire English teachers or buy English textbooks. So we had to make the effort to learn to speak Russian. And I am far from fluent. I'm very far removed from fluent. But to this day, I can still carry on a very poor conversation in Russian. All of our checklist had to be written in Russian and in English. So the left side of the page would be English and the right side would be Russian, or whichever way it was, it might have been the opposite. And it was a complicated flight. And like I say, we had to get a constant link to Mission Control Moscow from Mission Control Houston, because all of this stuff had to be coordinated with both nations. And it just came off flawlessly. And so the feeling of satisfaction after that mission was the greatest I've ever had. I had a number of challenging flights and a number of really interesting things that I got to do on my other four flights. But the degree of difficulty that went into this one was far greater than any of the others. And I don't see how it could have turned out better than it did. So it was just a big thrill, Jeff.
Wow. Well, one of the things that strikes me so much every time that you and I spend time together is this amazing dichotomy of being in space and with NASA and this massive organization and way of doing things, and then being home and rolling up your sleeves and being at the most grassroots level of general aviation. Was that like your kind of almost vacation reprieve from NASA? Like, how you were doing these at the same time and yes, setting records, which leads to your next record.
Yes. And in a way, you know, it was, I got involved with the Experimental Aircraft and the Experimental Aircraft Association, the EAA, in 1983, when I picked that cassette as a project to build and put together. And the partnership with the Experimental Aircraft Association has just been really pleasing and really enjoyable. Got to know Paul Poberesny and Tom Poberesny and Audrey and the whole gang up there at Oshkosh. And that was just a real pleasure to get to know everybody up there and get to experience all the things that I did with that organization as well.
Yeah, it really is striking to me that on one hand you can be docking with Mir, on the other hand you can be at this small grassroots airport like within days, and everyone's like, "Oh, what's going on? Oh, I'm waiting for my next mission right now. We're just spinning wrenches on a small plane, right, alongside everybody else."
Kind of in between missions, yes.
In between missions, I like that.
Yes.
So the next one, was that your closed course The next record?
Yes, happened here in Tennessee, where I live now. And what had happened was Bruce Bohannon, dear friend, once again, he had given me the new bubble canopy that I put on the cassette. He was through with his cylinders. I think they were Millennium cylinders that he was through with on his O200. And so he said, Hoot, would you like to have? And I said, of course I'd like to have those. So I actually sent my engine up to Matituck on Long Island, and they did a rebuild for me of my engine and put those cylinders on it. And then when I got that back in the airplane, I went to a carbon fiber racing propeller, and holy smokes, I was amazed at how fast I could go now. I had done about 230, 235 with the wooden propeller prior to that. And now with this carbon fiber prop on it and that new souped up engine, not really souped up, it had the same stock carburetor, the MA3P carburetor. So a stock carburetor. Now I tuned the timing quite a bit advanced. Normal timing for the O200 I think is 28 degrees before top dead center. And I was running 32 degrees before top dead center because I'm spinning at 4,000 RPM. And it's rated for 100 horsepower at 2,800 RPM. And so at 4,000 horsepower, it's putting out 115, maybe 120, maybe 125 horsepower, and it sucks up fuel a whole lot faster at those kind of RPMs. But it's really fun because it really makes it go fast. And all of a sudden, I had 155 mile an hour cassette, and so I got to looking at the world's 100 kilometer close course speed record for Class C1A. And Jeff, it had stood for 20 years, held by our friend Jim Miller in his Pushy Cat. So his Jim Miller pusher, he held that record for 20 years. And so I said, well, okay, I hate to steal a record from my good friend Jim Miller, but records are made to be broken. And here's my chance for another one. So in 2004, once again, I put all the paperwork, I paid all the licensing fees and all of the things I had to do. This time, Larry Steenstrie was my National Aeronautic Association observer. And I figured out a course. And this time, I don't think I had a video system because we had a better system, a device called a Volkslogger. And a Volkslogger is a device that receives GPS and it can track your entire flight and records your entire flight autonomously. It needed a 12-volt battery, so I had a small 12-volt battery to power it. And I had that for my documentation. And I'm trying to remember, I might have had a barograph as well, but I don't remember. That was a few years ago now. But anyway, the day I had figured out a course that I could fly, and that was from the Murfreesboro Airport to the McMinnville Airport, which was 52 kilometers away, if I remember that, around the reference point of the airport and back to Murfreesboro. And that would be 104 kilometers. And I got going and I leveled up. Oh, and I had to be careful. Now I could dive on the start, but I had to be level for 5 miles before the start of the course. And so the first time I started out to practice this, I did a dive. And I'm watching the RPM, watching the engine and all that stuff. And I glance over at my indicated airspeed and I don't remember what it was because it was faster than 250 knots below 10,000 feet. And so I don't recall how fast it was. And there was no recording. And I said, oh, holy smokes, I can't believe how this thing goes now. And so I went up and I practiced it a second time, Jeff, and the same thing happened. And so I figured out I cannot dive 1,000 feet and then level off at 1,000. So I could only dive like 500 feet and pick up a little bit of airspeed. I had to stay below 287 miles an hour. And I can't fly that fast straight and level, but I can sure pick that up very quickly in just a little bit of a rate of descent. And so I had to be really cautious on the record flight because I am being recorded. And and the way
you don't want to break any rules and speed limits when you're doing that.
If you break an FAR in the pursuit of a record, the record is null and void. So you had to not break any speed limits. And so, you know, I don't remember how fast I could have had it in the dive at the start, but I could not do more than 287 because that's 287 miles an hour because that's 250 knots. So I had to stay below that, below 10,000 feet. But I got stabilized on the outbound leg heading for McMinnville. And I had a small GPS, of course, that I was using to make sure that I didn't wander at all, because I had to be very efficient. And I'm on the outbound leg, and I look at my GPS speed, and I'm going, something is wrong here. I've got 255 indicated, and I'm only doing about 225 over the ground. I had a 20-knot headwind, and this is in the winter. The forecast was the wind was going to be 7 knots at 90 degrees to my flight path. And here I am, and I figured out I've got 20 knots on the nose, and everything is in place for this record attempt, so I'm going to go ahead and go all the way to McMinnville and back, which I did. So I went as low as I could legally go, because, you know, you can't fly over a farmhouse or anything below 500 feet. So I got as low as I could to get out of the wind. And it was unusual for the wind to be out of the east, because I'm going east from Murfreesboro. And so the whole thing was totally unusual. So I made the turn at McMinnville, and now the wind's behind me. So I'm really scooting along over the ground. And so you would tend to think it comes out even. No, it doesn't. Because what happens, the outbound leg takes you so long against that 20-knot wind that you can't make it up on the return. Yeah, the return is faster, but you will never make up all the time that you burned against that headwind. Mm. And so I crossed Murfreesboro, and of course, I've got the throttle. Throttle is at the firewall the whole time, and it's revving 4,000 RPM. Temperatures are fine, oil pressure's fine, but still it's a little nerve-wracking to run that long. And the flight took me from the Murfreesboro airport to McMinnville and back 16 minutes and 25 seconds. So I'm turning 4,000 RPM that whole time. And of course I'm saying, please hold together, engine. And I figured it would, and sure enough it did. But when I crossed the finish line, I had no idea if I had made it or not. And then one of my friends on the ground called me and said, Hoot, and it was garbled. It was garbled a little bit. And I keyed my radio and called back and said, I missed it or I got it. And he said, no, you got it. Well, then it's jubilation. So I was just thrilled. And so I had broken the record. Oh, and to break a record, you have to break a speed record by at least 1%. Now, an altitude record, you had to break it by 3%. And the 3% was 1% for the inaccuracy of the airplane's altimeter that set the record, 1% for my altimeter, and then I had to break it by 1%. Wow. And so actually, so I only had to break a speed record by 1%. I actually broke it by 4%.
Wow.
So it was a decent new speed record. And I was rather elated, letting the engine cool down before I came back into land. And then the picture that you showed a moment ago, the head of our EAA chapter here in Murfreesboro had notified the local TV stations. And so, by golly, they were there. And this is me shaking hands with Larry Steenstrie. And here you can see a TV camera. And the young lady was the narrator for the TV station. And our EAA chapter president, Dave Swindler, was the one that notified the news that we were going to be doing this. And so it was on the news, and they made a videotape of the show, and they sent me, I think I got to buy the videotape copies, setting that record. But that was fun. And so now Jeff, my little cassette, has a world altitude record and a world speed record. And so I tell everybody, okay, I want you to think of my little cassette the same way you think of the SR-71 Blackbird, because it has altitude and speed records. And there aren't that many airplanes that actually do that have an altitude record and a speed record. So my little green bomb is just like the SR-71 Blackbird.
That makes sense. I agree. Exactly. I'll give you that. No question.
Right. So that was fun. Now, the other thing that was really fun about a speed record is that it all happened down low. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget those high altitude flights with just an oxygen bottle. You know, you'd land and you'd have maybe a little bit of a headache for about half the day after that. And so they weren't as comfortable as staying down low and going fast.
Yeah.
So that was a nicer feeling. Those world altitude records. Oh, and did I mention it's a little bit cold up there at 27?
No kidding.
It's a little bit cold up there and pushy. The engine's behind me, so I can't even have any of the heat from the engine coming through the firewall, because it's back behind me. Whereas in the cassette, I had maybe a little bit of warmth coming through the firewall.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
No exhaust, mind you, but a little bit of warmth. But yeah, pushy, it was really cold being at 30,000 feet.
Wow. So after all of that, you managed to get the attention of lots of other folks, being not just an astronaut, but setting all these records. And so all of a sudden, you start going a bit upscale, shall we say?
Well, yes. Yes. So that was 2004. And I was at Oshkosh that year, because that record was, trying to remember when it was, I think it was in February of 04, February or March of 04. So I'm at Oshkosh in 04, and I'm talking to some of the guys from Hawker Beechcraft, and they had heard about my speed record. And in this picture, Joe Grubiak is one of the heavies at Hawker Beechcraft with the Beechcraft Premier Business Jet, which they are advertising as the world's fastest single-piloted business jet. So you can get a single-pilot rating in the Hawker Premier. And so we were talking about it at Oshkosh, and one of the Beechcraft guys said, you know what, that's what we need to do. We need to get Hoot to set a couple speed records for us to show off how fast the Premier is. And so they said, hey, if you'll agree to do that, we'll send you through flight safety and get you the qualification and the certification in the Beechcraft Premier, which that's worth quite a few thousands. And I said, okay, we got a deal. And so the first record I did was the picture that we had previously. And I was met at Phoenix by Trevor, who's in this picture, Trevor Blackmer, and the other guy in the red shirt, Joe Grubiak, and we flew to San Diego and we picked up Fred George, who everybody knows Fred George, and he's been a writer for several aviation magazines for years. And it turns out Fred was also in my initial F4 Phantom training class. There were, I forget how many of us, there were about 10 or 12 pilots and probably 10 or 12 RIOs, radar intercept officers, training in that class. Fred and I were in the same class. And so it's picking up an old friend because he was going to write about it in the magazine. And we flew from San Diego up to Seattle. And then the next day, we did a world speed record running from Seattle to Las Vegas. And we added more than 100 miles an hour to the record because it was held [S2] Wow. [S1] By a different kind of airplane. It was a jet, of course. And this was jets below 12,500 pounds gross weight. And we had a little bit of a headwind on that run, but we still added 100 miles an hour to the record. And we landed in Las Vegas, had lunch, and then we flew another challenging mission, Las Vegas to Wichita. And I think we put 200 miles an hour on that record because we had a tailwind on that leg. So we did two world speed records. Now, this is speed over a recognized course. But they were held by another type of light jet. And that's why they picked them, because we knew we could break them. And so we did. We broke those two records. And so that's a lot of fun. And so all of a sudden now I've got, I've forgotten how many world records I've got now. And that was in 2005. And then they called upon me again, Jeff, in 2009 and said, hey, we want to get some publicity and we want to do another world record. And so Hoot, would you be willing to come over to Geneva, Switzerland? Geneva to Chester, England, and do a world speed record for to Geneva, Switzerland, to arrive right at the opening of EBACE, the European Business Aircraft Convention, in Geneva. And I said, well, okay, if I have to. this was the airplane that we had to borrow because Premier had one, and it had a minor issue the day before we were to do the speed record, and so we couldn't use it. So on the spur of the moment, they offered this man, and I've forgotten his name now, but he very graciously let us borrow his airplane to do the speed record to Geneva, and I think he had a pretty good time because we went. And we did that speed record, and that took a bunch of coordination with air traffic control because over there, they don't want you to take off and go the wrong way to get up to altitude so that you can cross Chester, England at altitude on speed and then race all the way to Geneva at high speed.
With no turns.
Yes. Yeah. And so. So it took a bunch of coordination with the various air traffic controls, with England and France, to get all the way across over to Geneva. And this was a picture in Chester, England. What a gorgeous city that is. I enjoyed walking around and just seeing the place. And one of the things I marveled at was that there was a roadway that passed under the canal. I don't know that I've ever seen that anywhere else, but this was in Chester, England. And I was so astounded by this that I had to take a photo of it. So the canal, you know, they have all these canal boats that are long and narrow because the canals are kind of narrow. And so they had this canal all established, and I guess they needed a road to go somewhere else. So they ran it under the canal. I don't know how in the world they did. Well, engineers can do anything. So anyway, that was interesting. And so here we are. Oh, that other picture of us standing by the airplane. The owner and I are shaking hands, congratulating ourselves before we started. And here we are at the end of the flight, congratulating ourselves again after we finished. And that was really exciting. That's the first time I had ever been to Geneva. And what a beautiful place that is. And but we had to go. They made us go to the horse races in Chester, England.
Made you.
Yes, made us go there. Horse racing in England is really huge. It's like, well, it's just like My Fair Lady, like the horse race
scene. A lot of big hats.
A lot of gorgeous ladies dressed to the nines. And so that was, golly, that was a lot of fun. And then Geneva. Geneva is just gorgeous. I got some gorgeous photos of Geneva. And the sunsets over Geneva, over Lake Geneva, were just positively beautiful. And then, of course, EBACE, the European Business Aircraft Convention, is a big party as well. And so that was a whole lot of fun. Wow. And so these were the arduous world records that I had to go through and had to really work hard to get all these records.
But what a wonderful story that you started with just having the aircraft, knowing what it could do, and thumbing through these books, the world record books, and seeing, hey, wait a minute, that looks like something I could do.
Yeah,
I think winding up through this whole journey of setting them in space and then setting it in a Premier One going to EBACE. I mean, that is like bookending the most magical arc of grassroots to space and business aviation you could possibly tell.
I hadn't thought about it like that before, Jeff, but you're exactly right. It was, you know, starting very simple and relatively slow, but worked into some really great things. And you know, I got to do everything I ever wanted to do, and even more. You know, growing up, I had said I want to be an aeronautical engineer and a test pilot, and I had achieved those goals. And then along the way, I bumped into space shuttles and got to do so much more. So yeah, I just have no complaints. Altogether, I have 9 world records, 6 aviation world records, and 3 space world records.
Ah, how wonderful. Well, I'll tell you, every time we spend time together, it is an absolute treasure and a joy. I hope we'll get a chance to chat again soon. I am really grateful you've given so much time to everyone here on the show, being able to hear so much about your story. And it just goes on and on. And I'll just say to everybody else out there, this is such a tiny piece of things. I could hang out and just hang or fly with you for days on end.
Oh, it's true. There's lots of stories that you acquire in the course of flying jet fighters and combat missions. Yeah, I had a bunch of combat missions in Vietnam as well. And so there are some hairy stories that go along with that. And some there have been many, many times, Jeff, that when I got safely on the ground, I was thanking my guardian angel. And and there's a joke that I tell. Is that, you know, after some of the more stressful emergencies that I had, or some of the more stressful things that I had to do, I climbed out of the airplane. I heard this clanking noise, and it was my guardian angel throwing his gold halo on the ground and saying, "I quit. I quit. Find another guardian angel." So yeah, and that's
oh like man.
That's in my book, which is about to come out in, I guess, February or March is when.
So tell me what the name of the book is.
Well, yeah, the way the name came about was I worked on that book for just about all of 2004. And to preface it, I wrote a children's book along with 2 lovely women from Tucson that really helped make it a cute story. It's a children's book, and it's a story about a grandfather owl named Hoot. Who takes his grandson, who's a young owl, Andrew, flying. And this parallels what I do with my Beach Bonanza. I take my grandson, Andrew, flying in my Bonanza. And so we wrote a book called First Flight. And it has won two awards already. Creative Child Magazine awarded it their 2025 Book of the Year Award. Wow. And so I worked with a publisher, Tony Poshtian, out of Book Press Publishing in Des Moines, Iowa. And he said, okay, Hoot, this is great. Your children's book is great. Okay, when are you going to write your book? And I gave him the usual answer. I always say, yeah, I know I need to do that someday. And he said, okay, Hoot, time's running out. Let's do it now. He said, I'll coach you. He has written three or four books himself. And of course, he's helped many, many authors get published, publish their books. And so he guided me through the whole process. And I think I spent the majority of 2024 writing the 23 chapters that are in the book. Oh, and it was funny, Jeff, because he would say, Hoot, this book is getting to be too big. And I said, Tony, I only want to do this once. And so I need to include everything in it because I don't want to go through this again. So I need to include everything in it this one time. And he said, well, okay. He said, but it's going to be expensive. I said, I don't care what it costs. I want this to be something that my kids and grandkids can read. Because I never asked my mom and dad enough questions. I asked them a lot of questions, but after they were gone, it wasn't nearly enough. There were so many other things I would have liked to have known. So hopefully this will answer a lot of my kids' questions. And so anyway, to answer your question, I was talking on the phone with Tony Poshtian, and he said, Hoot, what are we going to name this book? And I said, oh, Tony, I don't know, maybe something along the lines of From Combat Pilot in Vietnam to Five Space Missions. And I said, oh, Five Space Missions. I must be a space ace. And he said, that's it. Space Ace. So that's the title. And I think the subtitle is something along those lines, you know, from Vietnam combat pilot to spaceflight or space missions or something like that. So anyway, it's called Space Ace. And like I say, it's going to be published in February or March.
Is when it's wonderful. So does that mean, Hoot, that we get you back here on the show to talk about your book in February or March when this launches? Or, and because I also want to talk about your military time, and we still didn't even get to that. So that seems like the perfect thing now that I have you on air, cornered, unable to say no. No, you can say no.
I'd be happy to, Jeff. These are a lot of fun for me. I know you've told me you really enjoy it, and I really enjoy it too. And so it's a pleasurable experience. It's a lot of fun. And so I'll be happy to come back. And the book could probably use some publicity. And I'm not doing this to make money. Like I said, I don't care what it costs. And if I don't break even, I don't care. I wanted to write this for the kids and the grandkids. And so, that's
I'm going to be part of your book tour, Hoot. So we'll be in touch. And when that book's ready to drop, my friend, you're coming out here. This is it. We're going to kick off your book tour here on the show, Space Ace with Hoot Gibson, from military pilot to space to legends of creation
and all and things
in record setting.
Okay, it's a deal. It's a deal, Jeff.
All right, Hoot, thank you so much for taking time to spend all this time with us here on Social Flight Live. I cannot wait to read your book, and I look forward to chatting about it.
Yeah, I'll have to have your address, and I'll send you an autographed copy. Okay, good.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay, all right, great to be here. Looking forward to the next time, Jeff.
You got it. Have a wonderful evening.
Okay, you too. Thanks a lot. I'll sign off. Bye.
And to all of you, thank you for spending your time this evening here on Social Flight Live. We're off next week for Thanksgiving week, and I hope you have a wonderful, relaxed, and special safe time with your families as well back home. And then we're here back on December 2nd. That is at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, here with accident investigator Greg Fife. He is one of the most famous aviation accident investigators. He'll be here on the show. Have a really good time. That is December 2nd, 8 p.m. Eastern, and all the other time zones that go with it. And then on the December 14th, the week after that, we've got our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff and myself, where we talk about all things from the cockpit and the flight instructor perspective, as well as maintenance. That's Cockpit, the number 2 in the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com to register for that show. And we're going to be talking about after the accident. What is it that actually happens after an incident or an accident? What do you need to know? What do you need to do? Very, very important things so that you can protect yourself, your rights, other people, the aircraft from further damage, you name it. We're going to cover all of that here in Cockpit to Cowl. So until next time, again, have a wonderful Thanksgiving week. Thank you so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live. Check it all out at socialflight.com, and I wish you all blue skies.
What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.